Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So you may have seen in the newsletter, the topic of this Dharma talk is, what does Buddhism have to say about mass shootings? So as most of you, I'm sure, are aware, just last week we had 3 mass shootings. And a lot of times these, you know, technically a mass shooting is 4 people killed at once. But there's something, because that also includes then kind of like gang-related killings and stuff. But there's something, I think, particularly chilling about these just well-planned episodes of somebody just going to kill strangers. Just a big episode of killing strangers, which is I know it's something that we don't enjoy contemplating at length. It's hard enough just, you know, hearing about these things, reading about these things. Who wants to come to the Zen Center on Sunday and talk about it there, too? So, this is just from my information. I would love if you would raise your hand. I'm going to ask a couple questions. If you don't raise your hand at all, that's fine. And that's kind of an answer in and of itself. So I'm going to ask, you know, are you glad we're talking about it today? Or kind of wish we weren't talking about it today? So who's glad we're talking about it today? And who would kind of rather we weren't talking about it today? I mean, that's instructive for me. That's the tricky thing about teaching in a group setting, is because you have to make assumptions in a way about what people need or where people are coming from, and you're always going to be somewhat wrong. Like on Tuesdays, I've been doing this series on active hope. How to face the mess we're in without going crazy, and I feel like, in particular, how do we find a way to respond, a way to feel like we're doing enough, etc. This is my deal, and there's clearly people involved who are really glad we're doing it, and I've also heard through the grapevine certain people saying, we have 12 weeks of this? Like, so it's like, you know, everybody's at a different place with things. But I'll just acknowledge that up front. But, I mean, to some extent, what is our spiritual practice worth if it doesn't help us, even encourage us to face reality and try to make some sense of it, find ways of maintaining our sanity and hope, respond with generosity and compassion? I mean, our spiritual practice isn't just a hobby to distract us from the difficult things. And I think this is part of what, there's actually a new book, and there was an article, I think, in Tricycle related to the book called McMindfulness, which is basically, it's taking these aspects of practice and it's making them into self-help or self-care, more like. So just self-care, something that you do for your own health and peace of mind, which is great, but it's also it's just a piece of what we do, and we have a much, you know, within a whole religious tradition, it's a much larger context. So I was thinking about that today, actually, how our zazen is, and maybe certain aspects of our practice, like chanting and things like that, that is our self-care. That is when we set all of these things aside and try to touch some peace and spaciousness and let go. But that's not all we do. Then we also have other aspects of our practice where we try to look at these things and wrestle with them. So, I don't know whether to just, I have a lot to say, which I usually do, so I can fill up the time. But just wondering whether it's worth just opening it up a little bit and saying, inviting anybody to share, if they want to, their thoughts and feelings about the recent mass shootings, the prevalence of this strange and baffling phenomena in our country, and hopefully sharing it being about our own experience, what is going on for us, not so much a commentary on who's to blame and what should happen. So I will just leave a few minutes for that, and then, you know, people can speak, and then, but if there's gaps or nobody speaks, then we just leave some space for contemplating this. So.
I guess what, you know, the book on self-care that you mentioned, is I feel like there's too much self-care at times in our society, and it's making the response weak. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at Puerto Rico and Hong Kong in their protests, and I feel like we seem to be going towards narcissism and self-care rather than really advocating for the problems. I wake up in anguish every day for those kids, mm-hmm. and there's the gun violence. I feel like even in Portland, right, you know, it's like a city that should be a city of protest is headed, is going into despair, self-care, and narcissism rather than a true response towards deliverance. And that's kind of what I anguish about. And I, a lot of my bend resonate that same thing, is there's a problem here in Portland.
I refuse to believe that it's an either or proposition. I think that it's both important to deal with reality as best as we can, while at the same time understanding that, at least for me, my own experience, it is important with self-care, because without it, there is darkness. There is a certain point that I have reached in the past where I became simply totally ineffective and unable to continue with whatever I was doing. And instead I went into depression. So I think that both are needed.
And children, I just tell them, well, you know, we're close to the zoo and a lion could get out. And for later, the prayer was over, half an hour of the children hiding under the bleachers in silence. We went back to our place, and, you know, we went back to the GO room to do the GO club. And to stand there with the other volunteers looking around the room, deciding how we could barricade the door if we needed to. Could they climb out that window? Maybe. Can we use that desk to barricade? I mean, it's unbelievable to me that I couldn't believe we were having this conversation. And I find, you know, when I go into public places now with my granddaughters, I consciously look to places that we could hide if we had to. And I think that anyone who thinks it's an abstract issue, or let's talk about the balancing of gun rights and the sentence, I think that they should go through a lockdown drill with a school full of children and see if they can come out.
Thank you.
Sorry, this isn't a very Buddhist perspective.
No, I think this managed to make this real, you know, as opposed to just kind of theoretical and philosophical. So I thank you for that. So part of our practice is to examine what is going on, particularly within us. So I just brainstormed a little list of examining reasons we're upset. I mean, obviously there's empathy for people involved. And there's really, you know, potent and physical and primal self-concern for ourselves and for the safety of our loved ones. That's, you know, which I'm, you know, enacting it physically like that would definitely, like, trigger a lot of that. But I think there's probably also people who are experiencing that. I mean, what was the story about, like, a car backfire in New York that caused a stampede? There's also concern for society. I mean, what the hell is going on with our world? And, you know, so there's a concern for society, but there's also a challenge to our worldview. I mean, it's necessary in order to function as a human being to feel like there's some sense of order, some sense of safety, some sense of predictability, and when these things happen, it's hard to integrate that or maintain that sense of meaning, of coherence, whatever that we depend on. So, the main thing that I'm going to talk about today is kind of the Buddhist view of how and why people can do horrible things, like the nature of human evil, which I think as we talk about that, we can be thinking about mass shooters, but we can also be thinking about the somewhat lesser evils of those who enable that to happen and those who turn a blind eye or, you know, the people, those of us who are responsible in some way as well. But first I wanted to just mention, because there's different aspects of this. So I guess this is more turning toward that self-care. How do we use our practice to stay sane and useful and not completely mired in despair? And I think some of you will be familiar with this. This is really based in Vipassana Buddhism, but Tara Brach has come up with a very handy acronym of RAIN for these steps that you go through when you're having feelings, which could be, I mean, there can be anger, fear, anxiety, paranoia, confusion, shock, overwhelm, sadness, disillusionment, despair, and even just kind of a bullish self-concern of just like, well, I'm just gonna, you know, build a wall around my house, and, you know, really staying with this kind of building our own safety and focus. So whatever's coming up, so the RAIN is recognize what is going on. Our mindfulness, and this is particularly turned to the intrapersonal perception. You know, what's going on in your mind and body, what thoughts are coming up, all of this stuff. So it's attention. Recognize what's going on. A is allow the experience to be there just as it is. Not trying to react and fix it. I is investigate with interest and care. They used to say investigate with kindness, which I kind of like as well, but apparently, you know, they work with this with many people, and they say interest and care is what they're saying now. So you're investigating it, but you're trying not to get too caught up in judging or trying to get rid of anything again. You're looking a little deeper. And then the N, now they have it, it was nurture with self-compassion. It used to be, and I like this is a little more Buddhist-y, non-identification. So over the process of doing this, we come to recognize this is something that's arising and falling. I'm not defined by it. It is something I'm experiencing, and you have a sense of some spaciousness around it. So RAIN, recognize, allow, investigate. I like non-identification myself, but. And it's amazing how this kind of process, you know, which is very, very based in Buddhist process and mindfulness, it doesn't sound like it should work. It really doesn't. Like, why would noticing your feelings and just allowing them to be, why would that help? Because we think of it as like, well, we find something that'll fix them, find something that'll make us feel better, or we make ourselves stop feeling that way. I mean, but it's not. It's like somehow coming into a different relationship with these experiences that makes them not such a problem. Because according to Buddhism, so dukkha is caused by resenting and resisting what is. And I was actually going to write down a way that it's more typically phrased. Dukkha is caused by wanting things to be other than what they are. But then I was like, that actually the problem is about the past and the present. Resenting and resisting the way things have come to be. There's nothing we can do about that. There's nothing we can do about the past. There's nothing we can do in this moment at exactly how things have played out. However, it's perfectly okay to want things to be different. So that's where a very useful differentiation for me. It's perfectly okay to want things to be different in the future. I mean, we can get too attached to that happening and cause more problems for ourselves, but my teacher would say, it's perfectly okay to say, I would be very happy if. It would fill my heart with joy if we found a way to reduce gun violence in our country. I would, you know, there's no dukkha involved in that. That is just acknowledging, you know, we're human beings and there's pain and there's suffering, and there's a difference between pain and suffering and happiness and pain and ease. So, but the dukkha is resenting and resisting our current state of affairs. And this is what we can let go of. It's not easy, but I don't know if any of you relate to this, but I can really just you know, there can be a lot of extra stress and exhaustion and sadness and frustration and horror. Just like, how do... I mean, I was sure when a grade school full of kids, little kids were murdered, I was like, this has got to be the turning point. So, you know, there's part of it just like, how do you accept that? But again, this isn't accepting in a sense that now you're not going to do anything about it, but accepting that that is what has happened. Coming to peace with what has happened. And that's the starting point. And the thing is, like, Buddhism doesn't... The cool thing about it, in a way, is it doesn't say that it should be any other way. It doesn't say we have a beneficent God that made a perfect universe, and therefore we have to somehow deal with the fact that this is happening. We just have a practice that says, you know, it looks like from the beginning of humankind, greed, hate, and delusion has really been driving a lot of the suffering. Always been that way. But there's something that each of us can do about that. We don't have to be under the sway of greed, hate, and delusion. So it's just very pragmatic. It's not, you know, it doesn't promise paradise. It doesn't promise a new world order. It just says there's something that we can do. Accepting, I mean, I've overheard a thing with Thich Nhat Hanh that talking about the state of the world, particularly with like climate change, and he said, you know, we have to come to a certain peace with the fact that our civilization may collapse. And again, it's not accepting that or thinking that would be okay. Maybe we do everything we possibly can to try to prevent that, but somehow not living in psychological resistance or fear to that even that possibility, which is just going to fill us with angst and anxiety. So the Buddhist view of why people do horrible things, for what it's worth, because I think there's this practice aspect of dealing with our own emotions and thoughts and maintaining our sanity and being the best bodhisattvas we can. A Buddhist worldview may or may not be helpful to you. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of just a philosophical thing. It's just a worldview. But I personally found it helpful. When I first encountered Buddhism, I was very distressed about all the evil things happening in the world. And I wanted to believe people were naturally, you know, kind of fundamentally good. Most of the people I met seemed to be, you know, at some level, you could appeal to their better nature. But then how does that happen? I mean, so that the perpetrators of real heinous things just seemed like black boxes. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know. They seem like an exception to the rule. And therefore, they're scary. Therefore, I can't relate to them. I don't understand them. I can't predict them. Apparently there's nothing you could do to change them. There's just the other is naturally a kind of scary, anxiety producing thing. So the Buddhist explanation helped me, you know, see into that black box a little bit. So there's actually two Buddhist answers. One is based in original Buddhism, so it's kind of the, you know, the original Buddhist, the Buddha's teachings himself. And then there's the Mahayana take, which is kind of an addition. It doesn't deny the other take, it adds to it, so I'll explain that. So in the original Buddhist view, we are affected by our karma. So originally they meant just primarily your past actions in this life and a previous life, but the modern view, at least the Mahayana modern view, is, you know, that's not the only thing we're shaped by. Obviously, we're shaped by genetics and culture and all this kind of stuff. But essentially, we are who we are based on all these past causes and conditions. How you were treated, how your personality, you know, genetics, who knows what. So there's a reason why. If you look for it, there is somewhere back there, there's a reason that led up to this. But then also in this given moment, anyone has some degree of choice about actions to take, body, speech, or mind. So we're not just talking about physical actions, but thoughts are actions, speech is action. So in this moment, we have a degree of choice. We can take actions that perpetuate greed, hate, and delusion, the three poisons, or we can take actions that start to relieve us of that, cultivate wisdom and calm and clarity and all of that. So, you know, that's in the Buddhist, original Buddhist teachings, it's always describing, you know, and in this moment, you notice, if I think like this, that happens. If I think like this, that happens. This leads to suffering and misery and immoral behavior. This leads to, you know, peace and good relationships. So we have this degree of choice, and no one is beyond redemption. So that there's that idea, like there's that freedom of choice, no matter what your karma has been. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with this story, but this is in the Pali Canon, a story of Angulimala. So Angulimala was brutal, this is a quote, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy to living beings. He turned villages into non-villages, towns into non-towns, settled countryside into unsettled countryside. Having repeatedly killed human beings, he wore a garland, a mala, made of fingers, Anguli. So Angulimala is his name. So the Buddha was walking along a road that was going to lead him right past where Angulimala operated. So people were warning the Buddha, like, you don't want to go down that road. I mean, this guy, he's killed, like, groups of 10 men, 20 men, 30 men, 40 men. He's just like, you know, dispatch them. Don't go down this road. But the Buddha just kept on calmly walking down the road. So Angulimala is like, all right. He gets up his weapons and he starts, you know, running after the Buddha. But he can't catch up. The Buddha's just calmly walking and Angulimala's running, but he can never catch up to the Buddha. So finally he stops and he yells, you know, stop, contemplative, stop. So the Buddha says, I have stopped, Angulimala, you stop. So this answer intrigued Angulimala, and he asked the Buddha the meaning of his response. And the Buddha replied, I have stopped, Angulimala, once and for all, having cast off violence toward all living beings. You, though, are unrestrained toward living beings. That's how I've stopped, and you haven't. So the Buddha had stopped the flow of the three poisons, where Angulimala had not. So the murderer experiences an epiphany, and right then and there, he renounces violence, throws his weapons off a cliff, bows to the Buddha, and asks to become a monk. Hmm. Now, the populace is like, you know, this is a bad idea, but the Buddha granted his request, and he proved himself to be an exemplary monk, and he attained enlightenment. However, he does eventually get stoned by an angry mob that's mad at his past actions. And then he goes to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, bear with it, you know, this is repercussions of your past actions. And actually, by bearing it, you are kind of cleansing your karma. So he attains complete enlightenment parinirvana when he passes away. So the gist is, no one is doomed, or, you know, everybody has that choice. So in the Mahayana view, so I guess from the original Buddhist view, it's not that we're, I don't know, it's not exactly a tabula rasa, but it's pretty much just up to us. We can choose to go the way of greed, hate, and delusion in any given moment and over the course of our life, or we can choose to go against it. And if you've gone down the greed, hate, and delusion route for a long time, you know, it's probably not going to be like Angulimala, an instant change, but you could change direction. Now, the Mahayana view doesn't deny that, doesn't deny the efficacy and legitimacy of the original Buddhist view. Your choices matter. You can allow greed, hate, and delusion to dominate your life or not. But we also see beings as fundamentally good. But this good isn't contrived. It's not a moral stance. It's not that inside I am, you know, I'm truly saintly if I just would tap into that. We're good as a result of our interdependence. That actually there is no inherent separation between me and the rest of the universe, between me and you. We're actually boundless. All things are empty of inherent self-nature. So when we really see our interconnection, I don't hurt you. I don't do harmful actions because we're wired not to hurt ourselves. And if we see everything as part of ourselves in a certain sense, then we don't hurt others. And we know, we experience this. We don't, those we love, those that we feel connected to, our children, we've never hurt them. Not knowingly. I mean, we've hurt them, but not deliberately. So, of course, people do hurt others, and they do hurt themselves. So from the Mahayana point of view, we agree that it's greed, hate, and delusion. But we think it's especially delusion. It's especially delusion. And in a way, the delusion is, I don't know about the easiest thing to attack, but it's the easiest, you know, delusions can melt away. There's nothing inherent in a delusion. When you see something clearly, you know, the classic story is like you're riding in a boat and a boat bumps into you and you're ready to like turn over and yell at the careless person who just bumped into you, and then you see there's nobody in it. It just became unmoored and just hit your boat. Like your anger melts away because you see what's really happening. So that's kind of that, you know, delusion can just go, and it's, again, it's not that easy, but theoretically it can. So people cause harm because they're ignorant of the true nature of self and reality. They imagine they can gain something. They can gain something by hurting, cheating, stealing, lying to, oppressing, reviling, even killing others. But of course, this is not really the case. So according to the Buddhist view and the Mahayana view, even if somebody temporarily appears to get away with something, it's just a matter of time before repercussions come. And even if external repercussions don't appear to come, their inner state is fraught with the repercussions of what they have done, even if they're not aware of it. And that is all levels. Alienation from others, fear of being found out, the thief looks behind the door. If you treat people like that, then you expect that you're going to be treated like that. Fear that others will take advantage of you, rigid dependence on a worldview that justifies your self-centeredness, an inability to enter into true intimacy with people and with life. If the more that you cut off, the more violence you create, the more cut off you're going to be. From the Mahayana point of view, we're all one body. We're all part of one body. And if the hand feels triumph because it cut off a foot, that is sick and deluded and has serious consequences. But, so, you know, Buddhism helped me conceive of those who have committed terrible acts as being more or less like me, as wanting to be right and good and happy in their own, perhaps twisted way, but suffering from a woeful and tragic degree of delusion. So the mass shooter doesn't think his actions are evil or wrong. That delusion has worked in there, that he sees his victims as inconsequential, or even feels righteous that this was some kind of terrible person, terrible type of being, intoxicated with a view that lets him see his victims as less than human, as different, or he sees his actions as justified, because he perceives his victims as belonging to a class of people who have treated him poorly, done him wrong, and they all share responsibility for his sense of alienation, humiliation, or pain. And this isn't to excuse it in any way, shape, or form. We're responsible for our actions. And it's also not, I mean, it's pretty difficult to feel sympathy. If you feel any sympathy, that's not a bad thing, but it's not required. This isn't about trying to feel sympathy, but at least trying to you know, open up that black box and see how this is a human being too, and we can relate. And how does this help? Like I said, these aren't obviously comforting teachings, but I guess that just being present with things as they are has a power in and of itself. And it does make perfect sense within the Buddhist worldview that now that we have technology that has multiplied many times over the amount of damage one person can do. And not just in terms of guns, but in terms of all of us and our, you know, the impacts of our lifestyles and all that, then it's greed, hate, and delusion is probably not any greater than it ever has been before. It's just we've multiplied the impacts that we can have. So if we do believe all people just want to do the right thing and be happy, safe, loved, and connected to others, we do have a place to start when we're looking at our society and thinking of how to solve these kinds of problems. We know greed, hate, and delusion can be stopped or decreased. We know anyone, even a hardened criminal like Angulimala, can choose the path of peace. And his story is repeated to this day in prisons across the world and in the United States, where Buddhists go into prisons, start groups with people who've done heinous things, and there are people who have really, really, really changed their lives because of their practice. Even though they, many of them are serving life sentences, they'll never get up. And in the meantime, you know, because it's like, we can't, all right, what's the likelihood you're going to get everybody to do spiritual practice? But at the very least, if we know all people just want to feel happy, safe, loved, and that's a starting place, there's things that we can do to try to help that happen, and therefore make people feel less separate, less alienated, because the more interconnected that they feel, the less likely that they will do something heinous and vile. So that's the Buddhist view. Let's open it up then for a few minutes of comments and questions. Yeah?
If I'm hearing correctly, I'm hearing the Buddhist perspective on violence. Within myself, I have a response, but either I missed it, didn't hear it properly, but what's the good response to the act of violence? Besides that prayer of not going to do good, not resisting, not being attached to a change, but the prayer that you're teaching should be happy.
Oh, I would be happy. Yeah. I think that's where Buddhism leaves our response wide open, because it all depends. It depends on who we are and what opportunities we have to act, and you know, what way opens up in front of us. I mean, I personally feel like our bodhisattva vow means it entails a certain kind of response of kind of trying to do what we can. I don't know if that...
I recently saw a little book by the Dalai Lama about, I don't remember the title, the anger's in the title, and he's basically saying this book, anger isn't related. Mm. But he's pointing out there are different types of anger. And there's anger that's generated by greed, anger and greed and delusion and ignorance. That's not the appropriate. He's saying anger generated by compassion. Let that anger energize or fuel your response and your action to do for things to be different. Don't deny your anger, because compassionate anger is appropriate.
Yeah. I think a lot of our... I mean, I'm just confessing that I had hoped my spiritual practice would mean that I didn't have experienced strong negative emotions anymore. You know, it was worth a shot. But I think then we can get into a delusion that we're just trying not to experience those things, and we just go away. I shouldn't be feeling angry. I shouldn't be feeling judgmental. I shouldn't be feeling sad. I shouldn't be feeling. But a lot of these feelings are, I think, yeah, like in Active Hope, we're talking about our experiences of grief for the world and fear and like, yeah. You should be sad and scared. Like this, and if we try to dampen those down or deny them in a way, we're shortcutting our bodhisattva, our self-preservation, and our bodhisattva activity. So I agree. Yeah.
There's energy in those strong emotions too, which so to speak to your point, which you can use to get yourself to do something. I think that's I saw some of what you've written to me. I think that's the kind of thing he was getting at, was it's human and perfectly appropriate to feel anger. The question is, what do you do with that anger? How do you channel that emotion? And I think that's
nice wisdom. Compassionate anger, not anger from delusion.
Yeah, exactly.
Shootings happened, and that this is all a ploy by the Democrats to take away our guns so they can impose a socialist communist regime, etc. And the anger I felt at toward him and the fear at that this kind of information is out there. And I basically kind of went into a depression. I just kind of just sucked it in and felt awful for days and days and days. And I'm just kind of now coming out of it. And, but it is that kind of self-care. We have to not remodel your kitchen, but actually, what am I feeling? Feel it. And then hopefully, you know, not own it. But it's really scary that people are picking up these guns and doing these things, and then there's people that are just in denial. Oh, no, that's not happening. It's a sort of a plot that's being made up. And it's, I'm not sure what to do with it. I'm still working through it, for sure.
It just seems like the dark night lasts a long time. Like you're saying, with emotions, and we're in a time where the dark night can last a really long time. You can't end it in a 24-hour period, even emotion. So that's what do we do?
I really like the rain. I've heard that before, but it's pain and rain. Pay attention to this. I like the idea that you have of that the choice idea. And it seems like what we're doing in meditation and the rain specifically is that we're allowing that gap to happen where we will have a choice. And without that, we're unaware of how our emotions are affecting us, or how our mind chatter is just being read.
Yeah.
And that in the meditation, and just by allowing emotions and thoughts and getting some gap there, that's where the choice comes in.
Yeah.
So that's how I see for me personally how the Buddhist practice is so important. That without that ability to see the gap between my emotions and my thoughts, there's no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I just get I feel like I get angry. In fact, on the way here, the traffic was really good. And there's Mercedes who was allowing me into. I was thinking, you know, all these bad thoughts. This guy is arrogant. And anyway, but to recognize that feeling, that anger, and have the road rage coming up, it allows me to be a human being and not to be angry. And I feel have bad thoughts, and in some ways the shooter and I are the same. He's just under a greater delusion than I am, and to have compassion and anger towards him, but also have compassion that he's being to do this. And that choice, I see he's clearly more of a choice to do right now.
And that gap, I think, is, you know, that is really what all of our forms of practice, but particularly meditation and mindfulness, usually if you came to Buddhist practice with some sense of that already, I would say it's because you did some other kind of spiritual practice before that, whether you called it spiritual or not. Before I came to any kind of practice, I'd be like, what? Like this stuff just happens. I just have a thought and then I do something and then, you know, it all just and it's like, I don't know, it's like meditation kind of slows down or opens up that whole process. But I, you know, your comment about the anger just, I totally relate. And I wonder, I'm curious about this book by the Dalai Lama, because I feel like, not just because of Buddhism, but culturally, and this is particularly true of women, but where we're just, you know, anger is like, ooh, don't, you know, scary, don't go there, you'll say something, because you do. Frankly, any time you let go of anger, it doesn't usually look that pretty, and, you know, usually say stuff that probably isn't entirely accurate, and then later on you have to, but yet, I know there's been times in my life where I have swallowed that, and it's like swallowing poison. It's like it festers. And there's a part of me that realizes part of my not wanting to just let it out in the moment is not wanting to be wrong, not wanting to look stupid, not wanting to look like somebody who's not in control of my anger. So basically it's ego. Like, I want to look good. So in a way, sometimes, like, is it is it time to just kind of go ahead and let that out if it's for a compassionate reason? And then maybe we'll have some cleaning up to do, but I don't know. That maybe we're too careful and polite sometimes and just like, as opposed to like, hey, wait a second, don't say that. Like, we'll see. Well, thank you all for a wonderful discussion.